Good evening and welcome to the New York Symposium. Today is September 6, 2024. I'm Diane Sayre, LaRouche independent candidate for U.S. Senate, and shortly I'll be joined by Richard Freeman, who is a longtime associate of Lyndon LaRouche and is on the economic staff of Executive Intelligence Review magazine, and we will get to that. Today is just 2 days shy of what would have been Lyndon LaRouche's 102nd birthday on September 8th. And many Americans, in fact, most probably have no appreciation of who he actually was and what his great contributions were. I will say simply for starters that he was by far the most accurate economic forecaster on the planet, perhaps in human history. And he was an 8-time presidential candidate whose case, the witch hunt against him, paved the way for what we see now occurring against not only Donald Trump, Robert Kennedy Jr., any candidate who wishes to challenge the criminally insane direction that our nation has been lurching, particularly since the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, finds themselves targeted by a peculiar combination of the FBI, Department of Justice, news media, etc. And I will say, as a candidate for U.S. Senate, it has been really striking me recently in the recent FBI raid on the home of my friend, former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter, the 24-hour detention of Syrian British journalist Richard Medhurst under bizarre terrorism charges, the fact that Tulsi Gabbard is on a terror watch list, how horrifically controlled the US media is. And I think they are escalating because we are very, very close to the brink of a thermonuclear war. And that was the topic of the discussion this morning of the International Peace Coalition. And Dave, if you're able to just put on the screen the participants in that meeting. Oh my goodness, it's really hard for me to read that, but thank you so much. So it was this organization was, or this group of people was assembled by Helga Zepp LaRouche, founder of the Schiller Institute, over a year ago. This group has now had, I believe, 63 meetings, not missed a single Friday. It began because of the Ukraine-Russia conflict. Then we had Israel-Palestine with the genocide occurring in Gaza and Netanyahu's efforts to widen the war to include Iran. Now we're back with Russia-Ukraine because it's clear that Ukraine has lost the war. And this is not something that NATO or the Biden administration can afford. So there is great danger of an escalation coming from the United States, perhaps in the form of a tactical nuclear weapon. Sorry about that, Dave, if we can go back to that now. So today we had Helga Zepp LaRouche, Dr. Ted Postol. You see, he's an MIT professor emeritus and the world's leading expert on nuclear weapons. He is a scientist. He does know whereof he speaks when he talks about the danger of these weapons. Ambassador Jack Matlock, who actually had been involved in the talks, and it says here he was Reagan's ambassador to the Soviet Union, or at least he was Reagan's choice of ambassador. He was present for the discussions between James Baker III and Gorbachev about the reunification of Germany. And he described that today in a really amazing way, where you had the sense you were reliving the history. You were hearing it from someone who knew it. The frankly incredible concession of the Russians to allow the reunification of Germany, even with Eastern Germany becoming part of NATO, on the assurances that NATO would not move one inch to the east and none of those nations would and would not have nuclear weapons on Russia's border. We had Colonel and Professor Wilfried Schreiber from Germany, Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Brossard. We had also former President of Guyana, Donald Ramatar, and a surprise appearance by Colonel Wilkerson, who was the Chief of Staff for Colin Powell. Now, what emerged very clearly in this discussion is there seems to be a consensus, which I find alarming, among top former military and intelligence professionals, people who served in various wars, people who were in the Pentagon, people involved in various intelligence over the last 30, 40 years, that the crew in Washington, D.C., making the policies has no clue what war is. They have no clue what the destructive potential of nuclear weapons is. You have people frivolously talking about using a tactical nuke, completely oblivious to the fact that I believe virtually every single war game done, no matter what the first nuke to be used is, shows that ultimately everyone is going to use everything they have and it's going to be over in about 90 minutes. We just had the Biden administration, the New York Times exposed that the Biden administration has changed its nuclear doctrine to be prepared for nuclear war. We are planning to put nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missiles back in Europe, in Germany, making Germany a target. And most of the American people are not even aware of this. So this is extremely dangerous. We have to pull back from the brink. We have to have talks. This conflict has to be ended. I was also struck by how strongly Colonel Wilkerson criticized Biden, in effect saying that were we to have a Nuremberg tribunal, he could be brought up on charges there for waging aggressive war, for crimes of which the Nazis were committed. He started the Ukraine war when he was Obama's vice president, and they overthrew the government of Ukraine and brought in a neo-Nazi regime that was preparing and planning for war with Russia over the 8 years until President Putin began the special military operation, which was not unprovoked. It was in response to actions from the West. That's a whole other topic, but I just go through this because, one, the danger of Kamala Harris winning the election, a rigged election, is indeed very grave. There is no evidence whatsoever. In fact, to the contrary, there's evidence that she would absolutely continue the escalation against Russia. She will continue the genocide in Gaza for anyone who thinks that she would not. And we will have an extreme clampdown on freedom of speech. And I think this is why former candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. last night sent an email to all of his supporters modifying his original announcement, which was that he was suspending his campaign, that he would remain on the ballot seeking to gain in the range of 5%, from 1% to 5% of the vote in states where it was very clear that either Trump or Kamala Harris was going to win, that his vote would not affect that. And then in the swing states, he was going to be withdrawing his name from the ballot so as not to throw the election to Kamala Harris, to not be a spoiler. And he further said that he had had a number of conversations with President Trump and felt assured that they were on the same page in ending the Ukraine war and defending freedom of speech. And in the case of Kennedy, he's very concerned about children's health and the health of the American population. So he believes that as part of an incoming Trump presidency, he can address these issues about which he is deeply concerned. And what he said is that because it would be devastating to the nation to have one of these close elections where no one knows the result for 3 months after the election, that he is now urging all of his supporters to vote for Donald Trump. As people know, I am not endorsing a presidential candidate. I cannot endorse the continued genocide against the population in Gaza, but I do have to say that Kennedy is right on this question, that the theft of the election, the imposition of a continuation of the Biden regime on the United States is something from which perhaps we would not recover, nor would we have a chance to recover. If we can salvage freedom of speech, at least we will be able to fight the bad policies that are going to come from a Trump presidency. And that is where we are. It's very difficult. That's why the campaigns of myself and Jose Vega and anyone else who is reasonable running for Congress in the United States are so important. Now, what does that have to do with our topic tonight? Well, why are these Anglo-Dutch billionaire elites so desperate? They have created a system which is at its end. It cannot be saved, no matter what you do. And there is a new system coming into being, very much along the lines of what Lyndon LaRouche and his wife were fighting for since the 1970s and earlier, but specifically his proposal for the creation of an international development bank. And the question is, which way is the United States going to go? So Richard Freeman and I just produced an article, which he will be saying something about. In a sense, it's sort of a case study and really only scratches the surface, but I think you will see it is a very unique approach, unfortunately, relative to today's fools who call themselves economists, in terms of how to assess a particular situation, how to forecast where it's going, and how to actually solve it. So with that, let me bring on Richard Freeman. I'm really glad you could make it tonight and join us, and I'm really looking forward to the presentation.
Well, thanks, Diana. I'm very glad to be here. I want to contrast two things, but let me start by Lyndon LaRouche once said that what you learn about economics, and most other things too, in college, to put it politely, is garbage. And that is the case. You have no idea, as most people, of what economics is. You might have an underlying sense from just what you think should be done, but it's not taught. And what we're going to look at tonight are two things. One is what has happened, using New York State as a microcosm of the whole nation. If you can think of New York State, and I did not know this until we did the work, Diane and I, that from 1840 to 1960, it was the leading manufacturing state in the nation. That's 120 years. No other state can claim that. And there are reasons why it ascended to that position. It is not there now. And it what we looked at was, what is the collapse? There's not what will become the collapse, but what is the collapse, which is the only proper standpoint to approach this. And then what I'd like to do is just give some highlights of that and show the article, which people can then get through the EIR, is to say some things about what Lyndon LaRouche's conception is. He has a conception of what's called potential relative population density, which I hope to explain a little bit of and not be able to go into it as fully as, of course, it deserves. But to give some sense of this, in my view, this is one of the most important breakthroughs in the last 1,000 years, which also gives you a legitimate conception of who Lyndon LaRouche is. It rivals the conceptions of Kepler, seeing the universe, our solar system, as a single harmonic system, of the idea of least action developed by Schnell and Wilhelm Leibniz and so forth. It is that powerful. And that's what we're going to focus on. But to give you some sense of what we found in New York State, I just want to state what the concept is for a potential role of the population density. We'll discuss it. But it's the increase in mankind's capacity to support greater population of a higher material well-being, of a greater cognitive power, and that through discoveries of principle in physics, science, and culture, you inject this into the economy through infrastructure, manufacturing, agriculture, and you raise this, you achieve the realization of this in forms of higher development, productivity, and so forth. That's just encapsulated. Now, to turn to New York State, what happened? I just want to give you just one or two things that happened nationwide. In August of 1971, the City of London and Wall Street, this axis, induced a not too bright President Richard M. Nixon to take the dollar off the gold reserve system, very important, which affected a tectonic shift that led towards building a huge bubble, the bubble that Diane has referenced many times on this show. I won't go into the bubble as such, but it's very important. And when LaRouche debated an economics professor who was a Keynesian in 1971, December of that same year, this was August 15th, 1971, he debated Abba Lerner. He said, look, we can get out of this. And he just did one quote, which I thought was very useful. Potentially, in terms of real economy, we could have a shift to production, productive employment, and very easily solve this problem if we only take the paper, which stands for fictitious values, the rising debt, which is essentially based on fictitious values, stock values, which are based on fictitious values, rents based on fictitious values. You just take this out and burn it and reconstitute the economy. So that's a conception. So then in the 1979, 8 years later, during the Columbus Day weekend, Paul Volcker, who was then Federal Reserve Board chairman, raised interest rates and kept raising them so that by December of 1980, the prime rate was 21.5%. And the entire world economy, and he said, by the way, this was on behalf of a policy that he called controlled disintegration of the economy. So this was intentional. And the entire world economy fractured. In 1982, you had the Garn-St-Germain deregulation of banking, the first start, and so forth. So let's see what happened in New York State. I want to just take a couple of the cities that Diane and I cover in this report. I want to take Buffalo, because Buffalo is a major city. In 1950, it was the 15th largest city, had 581,000 people. It was the second biggest rail center. It had the nation's largest inland port and 15th overall port, 12th largest port overall, sixth largest steel producer. It was the eighth largest manufacturer. This is all according to the 1950 U.S. Department of Commerce census. First slide, please. Okay, this is the Bethlehem Steel Lackawanna plant. And anyone who's old enough knows this plant. At one time, it was the one of the largest steel plants in the world. It employed 20,000 workers in the manufacture of steel. And just a few miles away on South Park Avenue, along the Buffalo River, was the Republic Steel Plant. And that was also a major steel plant. Well, as this slide shows, in 1983, the plant was shut down, was just closed, the Bethlehem Steel Plant. Republic Steel closed down. There's no major steel operation that exists any longer in Buffalo. There are some smaller plants. Now, what did that mean? Well, just to give you an example, there were 135,000 manufacturing jobs in 1950 in Buffalo. That slid down to 83,000 in 1999, and today it's 51,400. That's 62% lower. So These jobs were well-paying. They made a productive contribution to the whole economy of the United States and of New York State. And their loss meant that living standards in Buffalo began to plunge. And again, I'm just using Buffalo. We could pick several cities, which we do, like Rochester and Syracuse and so forth. And this led to a self-feeding downward spiral because more and more jobs went out. Tax revenue dropped, as you can imagine. By 2022, Buffalo's population had dwindled to 277,000. It was half of what it was previously. People just walked away from their homes. Buffalo has 16,000 abandoned homes. That's one out of every six homes. And in some areas of Buffalo, that you walk through blocks in which it's just, you know, it's 30 to 35 to 40% of abandoned homes. So Buffalo's rate of poverty went up to over 22%. Now we're going to see what that means for child poverty. Same story in Rochester. I won't go through the Rochester picture other than to say they went from 152,000 manufacturing workers down to 60,000. Schenectady, where they had the big GE plant, many people remember that. That plant had a lot of manufacturing workers, just has 5,000 workers today and has very few manufacturing. And New York City, which many people don't think of as a manufacturing city, it had 750,000 manufacturing workers in the 1950s. It's down to 57,000. It's lost 700,000. That means as a whole, if you take New York State, which was the largest manufacturing in the United States for 120 years, it lost 1.52 million manufacturing jobs. Now, this has a consequence. This is physical economics. Forget all the stuff you know, the monetary stuff, all the other stuff. Throw it out. This is the reality. We're in a depression. We're not headed towards it. That's where we are, or at least the physical economic collapse. In this situation, what else happens? I just want to show something. Next, please. This is the slide. I hope people can see it, but it's in hundreds of thousands. It's just thousands of jobs. There's two ways of taking the manufacturing of New York State. One is from 1950, and I mentioned it lost 1.52 million jobs. This is just from 1999, where it had over a 45% collapse. Now, I want to show you another curve. Okay, notice which direction this one's going. It's very pronounced. It's down. Next one, please. This is drug deaths from overdoses. Notice the direction of this curve. It's up, and it's from the same year, 1999. Drug deaths in New York went from less than 1,000 in 1999. They're up to 6,300, and if they keep on this trajectory, they'll hit 10,000 soon. 60,000 deaths just due to drugs in New York State. Do you see any correlation between the two curves? One goes down, one goes up during the same period. Do you think there could be a cause and effect? So I'm going to pose this to the reader. Next slide, please. Now you should recognize the people in this, and there beaming a second from left is Diane. This is at Beth Israel Hospital in New York City. This hospital is at E Street and I think 17th Street. So this is being shut down by a Wall Street gang, which called himself the Mount Sinai Hospital System. It's the biggest entity in here is Goldman Sachs. People are very familiar with Goldman Sachs' destruction of companies and plants and neighborhoods across the United States. So here's Diane, and she is protesting the shutdown of this hospital. If this hospital is closed, there will be no hospital below 17th Street. This serves 400,000 people. And I will just add that since 2000, and this depends on the source, between 28 and 48 hospitals have shut down in New York State, plus a whole series of hospitals in the rural communities are on the verge of potential shutdown because of their deteriorated public health. And if you are in a rural area and you have no hospital, you may have to travel 150 miles or more. And if you're having a heart seizure or you're having a stroke or something like serious, you were in a car accident, well, you can just imagine what that's going to do. And this, of course, will increase the death rate. And so, again, hospitals, I won't go through the whole thing. It's in the article on the bridges. But I will just say that the Brooklyn Bridge, which I always admire, and John Roebling built it in 1883. It was a marvel for the world, for the entire world. Well, you can figure out how old it is now, right? Because it's 141 years old. And the problem is that it got a rating from the federal government, the Federal Highway Administration rates the bridges and highways, of zero. There's no bridge, there's very few bridges in the United States. There are hundreds of thousands of cars that go over that. So it's a wonderful bridge, but you get the aura of death around a lot of the bridges and things that are breaking down in New York, which are just simply not repaired. And there's 15,000 bridges in New York State. Many of them, more than 1,500, are in a very, very bad rating. One more thing, Ken.
Richard, wait. Can you say what a rating of zero means? What does that mean?
I have to find this out. I copied this down. There are bridges that are called deficient, and deficient has a range, but deficient means it needs serious repair. In the case of the Brooklyn Bridge, let me just mention what its problem is. It has a midspan, which is the middle of the roadway or superstructure, is suspended by short rod suspenders. Now, almost everything today is but done by wires. Roadway dips, the main cables dip below the roadway. So it brings it very close to the main floor beams. It's just, these are construction things you would not do today. I don't know what zero means, but I do know that a structurally deficient bridge, defined bridge that has significant structural maintenance problems caused by deterioration, damage, cracks, or wear, and can be have collapsing concrete and so forth. How they keep the bridge open, I'm not really sure. If you read literature on this, they say, Diane, well, it's still standing, which is, I guess, a tribute, but not one that you would want citizens in New York to be exposed to. But it's a great question. What does this do to New York? What I want to concentrate on the end of this physical picture, and again, we have much, much more. And Diane described in this, which sort of prompted this article in the first place, that she had been to state fairs and the treatment, which Diane should fill people in on, or non-treatment that exists for people who have, overdosing and so forth of that sort. Next picture, please. Or slide, please. Okay, now this is New York State. This is the child poverty level rate in cities. 39.8% in Buffalo, 41.7% in Rochester, 45.8% in Syracuse. Those three cities, what does that mean? Well, if you're a child and you're born into a family of poverty, you're in child poverty. Well, what does that mean? That means that 40 to 46% of these of children in these three cities, which were major industrial cities, are all below the poverty level. Now, what does below the poverty level mean? Well, they give you a financial definition and so forth. What does it really mean? It means you don't have enough food. Food banks are only able to provide in New York State for 3 days, for three meals per day for families that are under poverty. What do you do the rest of the time? Well, you get some coupons. And otherwise, you don't have food. They don't have homes. They don't have places to live that they would stay in at night sometimes. They're living in cars. They're living in under bridges. And what Lyndon LaRouche would say repeatedly, in his economics, is you're producing the next generation of a labor force that has to have a certain cognitive capability to handle the expanding technologies which will be approaching. Can these children handle that? One out of every nine children in New York City school system, and this has been going on for 11 years now, are homeless. We're not producing a next generation. We are destroying children, millions of them. That's what we're looking at physically. Lastly, on the drug picture, the drug situation is just so far out of control that if you don't take it on soon, you will be having in New York State 10, 15, 20,000 drug deaths per year. And there's a whole culture of that that is being built up in New York State. The last thing I'll just throw out is that two-thirds, since over the last 25 years, two-thirds of all dairy farms have shut down in New York. And New York is a leading dairy state. It's the largest producer of cottage cheese, of sour cream, of yogurt, which are all three dairy products, obviously, and so forth. This is the condition of New York. And it's one of the reasons Diane's running, both being a New York candidate against Kirsten Gillibrand, but also a spokesperson, the only competent spokesperson representing both U.S. policy and world policy for the country, for the United States. In effect, she's running for president while running for Senate, as many of you have already known over many, many times. Now, there's much more. Can we have the next slide, please? Okay. This is an article, the article that Diane, I should have, anyway, the title is New York State Can Halt Physical, Economic, and Cultural Destruction by Sharp Turn to Development. And the issue is just the issue before last. This is the cover. It leads with Afghanistan and so forth. And I also want to thank Suzanne Klebe for her research, which went into this as well. I'm going to do something partisan. And I'm going to say that everybody who's watching this show, after it's over, if you are not subscribing to EIR, you should subscribe to EIR. It's not only got stories like this and stories on Afghanistan, which, you know, everyone's told the Taliban is just killing everyone, which is completely untrue. But the point is, it is also, it's not a magazine of record in the sense of the New York Times. It's a magazine of war. We are at war to turn this situation around. This is a battle, and you should have it. It's a war journal you need to read every week. And the last thing I'll just say about this is Diane just referenced the International Peace Coalition meeting, that which is remarkable for what it did. She went through it. That takes money, and we need support, as does the campaign of Diane Sayre. Let me make a shift, therefore. Let me say that what we have to do now is enter, this is the reality, we have to leave the world of monetarism and enter the world of real physical economy, of Lyndon LaRouche's breakthrough discovery. And what I'd like to quote is something that LaRouche wrote on his fundamental discovery. Now, I want to say one thing, because there's a lot of weird ideas on economics. And I'm going to cite two things that I think are wrong. And it's basically about their policies, not about their people. You'll see why I'm saying this in a second. But there's a libertarian theory, which is basically get what you can while you're on Earth. Get everything you can. Altruism, it's wrong. It's just, it's a fake. It's meant to deceive you. Fill up your belly, filled up your fast cars, and so forth. This is a hideous, hideous outlook. Now, there are some very good people in the Libertarian Party, like Angela McArdle, who people have heard from. But this ideology of ultra, and it's against the General Welfare Clause, because it says, don't regulate anything. Don't tell me how to run my life. Don't outlaw drugs. Don't tell me, you know, what to do about health emergencies. And the point is, if you combine that with monetarism, which is based on money supply, but basically says speculation, anything goes, which is the theory of Milton Friedman, which is, he's the poster boy for the libertarians, that you put those two together, you're going to have the type of destruction and the replacement of whatever passed for beauty in the United States by ugliness, destruction, drug deaths, and so forth. Now, LaRouche approaches this differently. And I want to say one other thing, because I want to get into LaRouche, but it also says, don't plan anything. You cannot regulate anything. Think of the dome of Bruno of in a count in Florence, the cathedral of Santa Maria del Fiore. Started in 1290, the construction phase was finished in 1420, and then Brunelleschi put the dome on and finished that by 1436. So you could see this was a project for 140 years. You have to have an intention and try and bring that intention into existence. That's what the plan is. You don't leave it to a free market. You realize what is beautiful and what is real economics. And that has to be planned. You couldn't build a beautiful cathedral. What were you going to say? Well, what's my rate of return the second year I build this thing? You know, okay, it's already 1340. Where's the money? I mean, it's an idiotic conception. Now, let's go to what Lynn said, and I want to sort of conclude with this, or at least get this started. This is a quote. I hope people can see it. And he says, and it's two parts. Now, this is written in 1993. Let me just say something to people. Lyndon LaRouche was born in 1922. And when he was between the ages of 11 and 14, he studied Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. And he already concluded in his mind, he says this, that the David Hume and John Locke and so forth and Smith, Adam Smith, were all wrong. I never heard of Leibniz when I was 14. I didn't even know any of the bad guys, Locke or Hume. I knew nothing about this. So when Lynn got to be 26 in 1948, he did an intensive study of which he did through 1952. And he calls this his original discovery. So I want to, in his own words, because then in 1993, on a paper called On LaRouche's Discovery, which Lynn wrote, which appeared in November 21st, 1993, he states two of the most important features of this. And this we get into real economics. The central feature of my original contribution to the Leibniz science of physical economy is the provision of a method for addressing the causal relationship between, on the one side, individuals' contributions to axiomatically revolutionary advances in scientific and analogous forms of knowledge, and on the other side, consequent increases in the potential, he called it then potential population density, he later called it potential relative population density of the corresponding societies. In its application to political economy, my method focuses analysis upon the central role of the following three-step sequence. First, axiomatically revolutionary forms of scientific and analogous discovery. Second, consequent advances in machine tool and analogous principles. Finally, consequent advances in the productive powers of labor. Now, I'll just say about the machine tools. If you have an idea and you think it's a fantastic idea in infrastructure or elsewhere, you've got to bring it into the physical economy. How do you do it? You just throw a leaflet saying, this is my idea? No, you have to build it into a machine, which can then build other machines incorporating this revolutionary scientific idea, like the heat-powered machine to start with. And that's what machine tools and analogous machines do. They transmit that. So that's why Lynn made that the second point of his discovery. That's, you have the idea, you transmit it through machine tools and so forth. And you can, now, second part of it. The characteristic absolute superiority of our human race over all lower species is expressed implicitly by mankind's rise from a bestial, baboon-like, rock artist-like potential population density of circa 10 million living individuals, to technologically determined potential of more than 25 billion today, and we could actually say 50 billion today. This change is owed entirely to a quality which the Christian Latin terms Imago Dei and Capax Dei, the Mosaic tradition of Genesis 1, that man, male and female alike, is cast in the image of God. This likeness is by virtue of that power of creative reason, which is most simply illustrated by a revolutionary axiomatic superseding of inferior by superior principles of scientific practice. Thus, in effect, mankind is the only superspecies, the only species which can willfully self-develop itself to the physical economic equivalent of a succession, a successfully higher species. That's economics. And I'll just say two things on this, because this is wonderful. And I know Megan DeBroat has been giving an excellent class of people should tune into this if it's still being given, because I think they'll benefit. The idea is that this, you have what's the invariant in mankind's economics? The invariant is that, first of all, you have a manifold, which is not a simple straight sheet of paper. We carry in our mind a manifold, and space has a manifold, which is embedded with what? With principles. A manifold is a curvature with principles. But if man is developing, we never are satisfied to know that we have one manifold. We are attuned by our creative reason and our musical spirit to want to move to higher and higher manifolds. We don't get upset by that. Well, I just figured it all out. Why are you changing this on me? We enjoy that. That movement from manifold to manifold is involved with what LaRouche is saying. And the other, which I will just say, is that you don't just throw things out. LaRouche works through what he calls market baskets, so that you can have increasing market baskets for households goods, market baskets for industrial goods, agricultural goods, and so forth, infrastructure and so on. What we are now facing can be turned around. And what the reason Diane and I put this together was this has to be changed. Some of it will be changed by processes that Diane left, put in a pamphlet called New York, Next 50 Years. But some of it has to be, and it's reflected in that pamphlet. It can't just be New York State. You want to build a Moon Mars project? You're not going to build that simply in New York State, though you will definitely have a space CCC in the Bronx. I can guarantee you that because of a certain candidate, Jose Vega, on this question. But if you're going to build a high-speed rail system that goes to New York State, well, you can try building it in New York City, but you have to make it an integrated part of 42,000-mile high-speed rail system, which I worked on with Hal Cooper. And he had the fundamentals. But the thing about it is that, therefore, what this report represents is that there are instances here and there. We pulled together, and as Diane said, we could keep pulling together. We had to stop at a certain point, but there's much more to be done. It's the only place in one place where this is pulled together, but it has to be done from the standpoint of man's using LaRouche's conception of potential relative population density, A, and B, admitting that we're not headed towards a recession or a depression. We're in a profound collapse. If we bring that reality and we use this throughout the state, but also as a statement of the United States as a whole, then we will bring reality to people and we can organize them around this, but through an approach that actually is real economics and will work.
Great. Well, thanks very much. I was looking for the cover of my pamphlet, which is actually called America's Next 50 Years, because it does have to be national. It's okay.
I couldn't remember exactly.
Yeah, No, maybe it would be helpful for you to say, because I think people have a very hard time considering this. And I think one of the problems is the axiom that somehow Wall Street is engaged in some kind of a respectable activity. And if you could elaborate on what Lynn is saying about the question of bankruptcy, Glass-Steagall, why these are necessary steps.
Absolutely. And Lynn has made clear that there's going to be a point of financial disintegration. But the thing I would just keep people in mind, things will get worse, but you do not need if you have 50 years, 60 years of in the triple curve that Diane had on the announcement for the show, where the upper curve is sucking out the productive capacity of what is the real physical economy to the point that you're no longer producing it. The workers can't exist, manufacturing shutting down, but they can't support their families. You can already have a collapse. It just means that within financial paper, this fictitious paper that LaRouche said you should burn goes, you have nothing. It will be like a fire. If you've ever talked to a fireman, the fire gets very hot and burns things. But at a certain point, and I actually went and once had a lunch with a few New York's finest firemen, and they explained this to me. It's called the backfire. What happens is it reaches a certain point and it forms a shock front. And the heat is such at that point that it can melt bricks.
Wow.
And then that's when things go. And that's what we're facing when bricks are melted. So what do we have? What we've had is, as production has decreased, and if you could just look at the manufacturing workers, a fall of 64% since 1950 and 46% since 1999, which is one good indication of that, and shut down of 2/3 of all dairy farms in New York State so that the people who are buying this can build windmills. Most of this is being bought by foreigners, not the Chinese, as being said, but the largest of the Canadians, the British, Cayman Islands, which all three are part of the British Commonwealth, and then there's two other countries. Not a single farm has been bought, at least documented, by the Chinese, even though we're being told that they're buying farms in New York State. So what has happened? Well, instead, you have rackets. Let me describe one racket, which we don't go through, but I had a discussion with Jose about this because he mentioned this to me in the Bronx, where there are people who are caught in rents, small businesses, who are caught paying rents. They can't pay the rent, but they're not being allowed out of their contract by the owner of the building. The building is collapsing and so forth. Now, this is in New York, but it's also elsewhere. The real estate interest in New York, and this is an example of what Diane's referring to, is a very powerful lobby, extraordinarily powerful. The real estate market in New York State, New York City alone, is about $1.5 to $3 trillion. What's done with the real estate market? You keep marking values up and up. One of the things it's done, and we did studies of this in the 1970s for Mr. LaRouche, is you launder drug money. If you've got money offshore and you want to bring it onshore, one of the ways you bring it onshore is you buy a building. And then the building, someone holds it, let's say building owner A, for 6 months, sells it for a 10% markup in another 6 months. The money's now onshore. So you've got this market where the office building rents can't be paid, but then they put these on the buildings in Harlem, in the South Bronx. You would say, well, how can you charge that? How can you maintain that the building's price is going up when the hallways are collapsing, the stairwells stink, the plumbing doesn't work, there's no heat? So think of this. You've got a rising price value, and your physical entity underneath that price value is collapsing. Does that make any sense? That is one example. And real estate, as I said, is very powerful in New York. It often determines who, one of the things that determines who becomes mayor, because you have to either play games with this market group or you're out. you can just forget the idea of having, you know, I'm a knight on shining armor with shining armor on a white horse. Forget it, doesn't happen. Real estate market and others, and of course, Wall Street being here as well. Similar processes, and LaRouche called this, by the way, and this is very important because I referenced this earlier. He called this fictitious value. You can see it. The value goes up, market value, and the physical value goes down. What's the discrepancy between the two? LaRouche called it fictitious. And the fictitious valuation is going up. It's widening. But to support this fictitious value, and this is part of the triple curve, you have to increase the money supply to keep recirculating things which have no value. And I'll get to what Diane was saying about the Glass-Steagall in a second. But this is true for other features. I mean, look at this. We have an electricity shortage. We shut down nuclear power plants in New York State, which if any candidate was running for president had any brains, he or she would be at Indian Point and holding a rally, and we would be there as well. Have they done it? And what's this electricity going for? Well, a part of it is going for these Bitcoin, because the way it's not, when they say Bitcoin mining, they're not digging with shovels. If you use what's called blockchain, you record every transaction, and then the next transaction, and then the next transaction. The problem with that is that to every trade now has more and more documentation. You have to have gigantic amounts of electricity for that. And then you have these centers, which are, of course, data processing centers. So we're going to do some studies on the electricity for the EIR over the next weeks to try and get at what's being actually taken and whether you're supplying it with windmills and which don't work when there's no wind and solar panels, which don't work when there's no sun. That's a very intelligent. And we're also taking out farmland, which would produce dairy products so that we can also have this too.
Well, you know, Buffalo has sun all the time. That's why they're building so many solar panels there. It really is quite insane.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. They don't have it. No, they might, because the blocks won't have many houses left and you'll just get straight sun, but people won't let it grow grass and green things.
Right. But they do get a lot of snow, which doesn't help the solar panels.
That does not. It does not. So the thing is, you therefore have shifted the economy to what Lyndon LaRouche called a post-industrial society. I think most people can, after industry, which is why Paul Volcker in 1979 said, we're going to go into control disintegration to accelerate this shift. And we had pictures on the covers of EIR of one steel plant after another in Cleveland, in Buffalo, in Indiana, just being blown up. They were blown up. So you have these fictitious values, and then you have the trading cycles that are going on. Plus, people focus on correctly that the United States government has $33 trillion of debt. But if you take also the debt of financial institutions, which is a massively big of Wall Street, and of homeowners, and there are also more credit cards, and you add into it the other debts, the United States has $81 trillion worth of debt. If you sold every brick in every building in America, you can't pay it off. It's fictitious value. And yet slavishly, we honor that value to the people who even pay attention. Okay, what does that do? It sucks out more of the industrial base and the agricultural base, which means that you have increasing values, and even the physical capacity to keep it minimally going is disappearing. We saw signs of the collapse of this in 2008 through 2010. This was responded to by the U.S. government using various treasury agencies and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the Federal Reserve Board putting forward $19 trillion of money to try and hold this up. Some of them were credit lines. You can't keep doing this thing. So what you need to do, and remember what I said about you reach a level at which the fire suddenly just is now turned into a shockwave. It's no longer a fire. And but it's a heated shockwave, sort of what we were told earlier about by Dr. Postol. You get rid of it. And what you do is the purpose of Glass-Steagall is, some people say it's divide one bank into two banks. Technically, that happens. Some people say it's to protect people's savings. Of course, you want to protect people's savings and checking accounts and so forth. We have to break the power of the system. We have to move mentally out of the monetarist world. You cannot serve two masters. It's what Abraham Lincoln said. You cannot be part free and wholly run by the system. It won't function. Anything you try and do in that system will disappear or not function. Put it through bankruptcy reorganization. Write down this fictitious capital by 60, 70, 80%. Do a fair accounting and so forth. Back up pension funds. Back up people's savings accounts, their checking accounts, because you have to be able to write payroll. But it is an emergency decision. We either do it now, rationally, or we will have this come down on our heads and it will be irrational. And it will lead to a fascist movement. I do want to say this. Let me just say that.
Well, you're not going to leave us in suspense, are you?
Well, LaRouche talked about Hjalmar Schacht when he did his August 15th, 1971 piece on when Nixon took us off the gold reserve system. And people sort of think, you know, we don't have any fascists walking around. Well, we actually do, in the form of people who want to kill people to keep the system going. But there's a misbelief, which LaRouche really went at in his first few years. So I first met him in 1969. And he said, look, it's not your military wing. Yes, they'll participate in these things. It's not your nationalists who create fascism. It's your liberals. And they don't create it from the bottom up. They create it from the top down. And some of the people that they create, he wrote a wonderful article, New York, New Left, Local Control, New Left and Fascism. It's a wonderful pamphlet we produced way back when. But he says there, he says, look, it's the displaced white collar worker who is going to form the basis of this, because they're going to become enraged because their world is collapsing. They don't have a productive sense. Even if they've been laid off, a productive worker has something to do, something. I've built something. I've constructed something. A farmer knows that they what they do. They're going to be out of jobs, and they're going to be enraged. And that's how you recruit the fascist movement. I'm not saying it won't have workers and so forth, but that's where it's coming from, will come from. And people are looking in the wrong place. It's run by the bankers, the Hitler project. I won't go through it here, but it was run by a banker named Montague Norman, was head of the Bank of England. And he worked with a person named Hjalmar Schacht, became finance minister for Hitler. But they had to get Hitler through the period when the Nazi party was plummeting in 32. This vote was falling apart. And they had to deepen certain economic crises and so forth to bring them to power. That's how Hitler, who was just a front person. I mean, he was evil, yes. Killed people, yes. But he was a front person. That's who ran it. So that's the danger. You just don't go into a collapse and everything, people's scales from their fall from their eyes. That's why the Diane Sayre campaign is so important. We have to educate and give a humanist, people I know revolt against that word, or a real, you know, Imago Dei concept of economics, because it's the only one that works.
Thank you very much. And I will just underscore that the incumbent Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is absolutely part of this Wall Street military-industrial complex. Her in-laws, her father-in-law, who is British, was an executive board member and worked with British Aerospace for many years. Her husband, similarly, she is absolutely part of this. And by the way, I have to add, speaking of freedom of speech, I neglected to mention, it turns out that this horrible legislation of which she was the primary co-sponsor, called the Restrict Act, which was designed to stop any spread of information which might be of benefit to the enemies, our alleged adversaries. Of course, we haven't declared war in the Congress against anyone, so I don't know why we have adversaries, but Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, Cuba, who am I forgetting? One more. They'll come up with more anyway. We're going to have a lot of adversaries if we keep it up. But it said that an individual could be put in prison for 20 years, fined $250,000, and that you weren't allowed to make a FOIA request to find out what you're charged with. So I thought that this bill was just so egregiously fascist that it had died in committee, and it did, but they redid it. And because I called out Gillibrand on numerous occasions for being involved in this horrid piece of legislation, she is not a sponsor or co-sponsor of the new bill, but it's on the website. There is even a website for the Restrict Act. It's like restrict.com or something. And the new bill is called Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversaries. And it's largely directed against TikTok, and ByteDance, I think, is the owner company of TikTok, but not only that. And they say any platform which has more than 1 million users in a month and which is foreign owned can be targeted. You can be fined $5,000 per user. So what that comes out to, it's just designed to silence anybody. And I think that this is what we're seeing. And by the way, this one passed both houses of Congress and was signed into law July 24th by Biden. So when you look at the crackdown on the Russia Today, the RT journalists, what happened to Scott Ritter, what's happening to many others, these persecutions, I say persecutions under the Foreign Agent Registration Act. I think we're looking at this. And it is out of desperation. It's exactly what you say. You know, I think you didn't mention, but the critical quote in that debate where Lynn defeated Abba Lerner was, he said, if Hjalmar Schacht had been listened to, Hitler would not have been necessary. So they know that you cannot impose these wacko economic policies that are going to kill billions of people unless you have dictatorship and war. So guess what? That's where we are. So either we reject the economic policies, or at this point, we're about to have Armageddon. And I'm optimistic. You know, Helga, I don't say that to understate the danger. I think it's very great. But she said you have to consider that human beings are fundamentally good, that human beings are capable of change, and we have to get that change to happen, and it has to happen in the United States urgently and quickly.
On that point, Diane, look, yes, first of all, human beings really do want to survive. Now, there may be strange ideas about it, but they do. And that is where why I took on the premises of the monetarist libertarian, and you could say the same thing for the liberals too. We in teaching economics, we have to shift it. Look, it's not even as wonderful as putting fusion, which, you know, there are certain important advances that it's still work has to be done. There's many other things to do. As wonderful as all the machines you can have, the ultimate goal of mankind's economics is mankind to a higher level. That's why we do it. We don't do it for other reasons. So those are all wonderful expressions of what we need to go to the next step. Once you shift mentally to that, you can see why what Diane is saying is true. Because if we can simultaneously organize out of this collapse, that's what it is, and do it not through some mechanism hocus pocus, but making people realize why they have a family, why they were challenged, why when they get an idea that's exciting, like what we they'll see on Diane's shows, they get excited. Well, elephants don't do that, right? Whales don't do that, but we do. Is that wrong? Or is that accidental? And but you really have to have an economy and that's where you focus. They're the same thing. Once you realize that, that life can be fun, even though under very difficult circumstances like nuclear war, but life can be fun and enjoyable and it can follow your intention. And when you do things, the universe signals back to you whether it works or not. And on making discovery after discovery, where's our testing ground? This is why Luhrer said economics is the highest and subsumes physics and biology. It took me a few years to get past that because I kept saying, well, I don't see this exactly. I know Lynn's right on a lot of things, but I don't exactly, emotionally, I don't see it. It's because when you apply these ideas to the universe, you have an hypothesis and you have a higher hypothesis. And you see what the universe does. Well, how do you express your ideas of biology and physics? Through the human species activities upon the world. That's really economics. That's what it is. And we do it as a species, not as individual hardballs. And we do it through intention. Like they built the cathedral in Florence. It's enjoyable. And then to plug September 15th, how do you celebrate that capacity which you discover? You don't know you have it. Man, once you discover you have it, you realize that that must be the highest part of the universe, not the lowest part. We're not standing outside the universe looking at it. We're in it, and that's the highest part. Then you do a social celebration. That's music. That's art. And Diane will tell you about our concert on the 15th.
Okay. Yes. So on September 15th, the Schiller Institute NYC Chorus, which I founded 10 years ago this year, will be doing our annual 9/11 memorial. So it's Sunday, September 15th at 5 p.m. And we are celebrating the legacy of American classical culture, going back to Brahms and the African-American spirituals and the work of Antonin Dvorak and others. It's going to be just a phenomenal concert. So please visit. I'll put in the chat the Schiller Institute Chorus website. I think if you Google it, you will find it. But it's Schiller, S-I-N-Y-C, chorus.com is the website, S-I-N-Y-C, chorus.com. You can buy tickets. It's only $20 in advance, $25 at the door. And you will be so glad.
Where is the door?
It's at Our Lady of Mount Carmel. Thank you. In Little Italy in the Bronx. And that is where they have the best mozzarella cheese in the United States. So you definitely want to go there. Yes. So it's Our Lady of Mount Carmel, Sunday the 15th. So thank you very much for joining me in this discussion and for your efforts. And I hope we do a lot more. There's a lot of work to be done. Our article was just the beginning.
Good. Great. Great collaboration.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.